call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We do have a quorum present. Representative Kraft, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 4th, 2023?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Kraft moves approval of the minutes for January 4th, 2023. Any discussion, members? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 4th, 2023 are approved. Members, the first item on our agenda is House File 6 from Chair Stevenson. Chair Stevenson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 6 be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Chair Stevenson moves that House File 6 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. We have an amendment, A23. Chair Stevenson, would you like to move and describe the A23?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A23 amendment, which is an author's amendment to get this bill in the shape I would like the committee to consider it in. It incorporates a number of discussions with stakeholders that we had in advance of this bill last year, as well as some tweaks for this year.
Okay. Members, any discussion to the A23 author's amendment? Hearing none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is a bill to ban price gouging during emergencies, and I'll start by a discussion of a real-life example. Last year, we had an extreme weather event that covered most of the middle of the country. Record cold, ice, and snow hit Texas, Oklahoma, and other states. Due to deregulation, incompetent grid management, and impossibly poor planning by both public and private sector officials in Texas, hundreds of thousands of Americans went for days without power. Across Texas, the reports of huge spikes in the price of essential goods and services, food, bottled water, hotel rooms surged in price, making a terrible situation even worse. The fact that people profited to an absurd extent and took advantage of the pain and misery of others in a moment of despair is just plain wrong. Fortunately for Texans, their state has a law against price gouging during an emergency, and it's a tough one. Violators can be punished up to $250,000 per instance. 35 other states have laws against price gouging during a disaster. Minnesota, by contrast, has no such law, and our citizens would be without recourse if something like what happened in Texas were to happen here. This bill would change that. It would make it illegal to price gouge during a disaster declared by the governor. It also establishes clear expectations for what is permissible and impermissible pricing behavior during an emergency, because businesses deserve to know what they can and can't do in those circumstances. Some people watching this debate might be surprised to learn that Minnesota doesn't have a law against price gouging during an emergency. In particular, I'm sure some people are thinking back to the COVID-19 pandemic in the early days when we had toilet paper and other essential goods go up in price. And it's true that during the emergency, the governor initiated Executive Order 2010, which prohibited selling essential goods and services for unconscionably excessive prices. After implementation of that executive order, the Attorney General's office entered into over 100 informal resolutions and 6 court-filed settlements stopping price gouging and recovering restitution. And it's certainly a good thing that happened. I'm glad the governor and the Attorney General were able to use the power that's vested to them in Chapter 12 to protect Minnesotans. But I think over the last couple of years, we've had a long discussion about whether we want such broad, expansive executive authority or whether we want the legislature setting policy. And so last year, I worked with a number of stakeholders to craft this resolution, or this bill, rather, that tries to codify some of the protections that were put in place by Executive Order 2010 with some additional guardrails. And we had long and extensive conversations with stakeholders, in particular the Minnesota Retailers Association. I want to thank all the stakeholders for their continued involvement in putting this bill together. Last year's bill moved out of this committee with bipartisan support and passed off the House floor also with bipartisan support. I'm hopeful that we can achieve bipartisan support this year as well. Last year, our friends in the Senate weren't willing to take action. I'm hopeful for a different outcome this year. And so with that, Madam Chair, I understand there are a couple of amendments.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. So members, we have the A2 amendment. Representative Niska, would you like to move and describe that A2 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A2 amendment. My overarching concern with this bill is that in an abnormal market condition, we require businesses to bring goods and services to market. The only thing worse than high-priced goods or services are empty shelves. And so the point of this amendment is to help make sure that those good businesses that are trying to bring those essential goods and services to market, if they do get investigated, that the process itself doesn't become the penalty, and so that they are able to have some certainty about whether that investigation has found price gouging or whether that investigation has found that they are complying with the law. And so the purpose of this amendment is just to, as with a lot of administrative proceedings or investigative proceedings, to bring certainty to those who have been investigated so that they can say either they can go on and have due process if the investigation goes forward into court, or they can show that in fact the investigation has stopped and no further action is being taken. So that's the purpose of the A2 amendment, and I move that it be adopted.
Thank you, Representative Niska. Chair Stevenson, any response?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska, for the amendment, and certainly share your view that businesses deserve certainty and deserve due process. I will be asking members to vote no on the A2 because I think this goes beyond that and would create a very exceptional situation that doesn't exist in other attorney general investigations or speaking as a prosecutor certainly doesn't exist in the criminal world. So what the NISCA amendment does is it says that once the investigation is complete, the attorney general has to notify the target of the investigation that they're either going or no going on it. I'll just tell you that as a prosecutor, if we initiated a criminal investigation to someone, we don't typically at the end of that send them a letter saying we're not doing anything. And the reason for that is really straightforward. Investigations can go on. New evidence can come to light. Oftentimes people would interpret the end of an investigation, a letter like that, as a finding that no wrongful activity has occurred, which is not at all what an investigative agency would be finding. They would just be finding that there wasn't enough information to proceed forward. You know, in other words, we don't typically find people innocent. You know, we find there isn't enough evidence to proceed in an investigatory context. So I don't think it's consistent with how we do things across the board, and I don't think that we should make an exception here. So I'd ask for a no vote.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Members, any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right. Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A2 amendment is not adopted. We have the A3 amendment. Representative Dowd, would you like to move and describe the A3?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I would move the A3 amendment. This is an amendment that takes the language in the bill under Subdivision 5 civil penalty. In the author's amendment, or the bill as it is in front of us right now, it states that there is a fine or civil penalty of up to $1,000 per transaction with a maximum penalty of $25,000 per day. So my amendment would reduce that $25,000 per day down to $10,000 per day. That's actually what was in the bill last year, and Mr. Chair, I know how hard you worked on that last year, and I want to assume that you were not 250% wrong last year, and that we should have that large of an increase from last year's bill to this year's bill. So while I think that we want to make sure on both sides of the aisle that no one is taken advantage of in a situation where there's a state of emergency and they're purchasing goods or services that they need, that someone is taking advantage of them. So we want to make sure that that is not happening, but I also want to make sure that we're reasonable in the punishment. So $10,000 per day or $25,000 per day, there's a big difference between those two numbers. So I don't think that we need to be excessive in our number. And if $10,000 was good enough last year, I think it's good enough this year. So, and I understand that the Attorney General would probably like it to be $1 million per day, but I think $10,000 is probably enough. So I would encourage members to vote for this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Doubt. Chair Stevenson, any response?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Doubt. And I mean, if we're going between $1 million and 10,000, I'm way closer to you than the Attorney General. You know, it is true that in the bill last year we were at 10,000 and this year going 25,000. I think after talking over with, among other people, the Attorney General's office, I think 10,000 was a bit low. The Attorney General's sort of plenary authority that they relied upon in the executive order 2010 allows them $25,000 per incident. So this is still a significant reduction from where we were during the state of emergency. I also will note that a lot of states are a lot higher. I mean, you heard me say in my opening remarks, Texas at $250,000. I didn't pick $25,000 out of thin air. This is where Florida is at with their price gouging model. Florida, a state that has a lot of experience with emergencies. So I think it's good to be consistent there. And look at it this way, at $25,000, you can say we're a lot more friendly to business than Texas. We're a more business-friendly state than Texas. Isn't that pretty good? I'd ask for no vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, any further discussion? Oh, I see Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Doubt Amendment, I realize we've had some inflation in our economy, but for 10,000 to 25,000 in less than a one-year period of time seems a little, well, excessive. And that's the spirit and intent of this bill. Maybe we want to reevaluate the fine range again. Mr. Chair, again, I just ask you to consider the spirit and intent of what we're looking at today and maybe consider supporting the Doubt Amendment.
Chair Stevenson, any response?
Having considered it, I'm still asking for a no vote.
Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I said it under my breath, but $25,000 sounds like price gouging. So maybe we should not price gouge in our own price gouging bill. So I'd still encourage members to vote no.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or excuse me, vote yes.
All right, any further discussion, members, to the A3 amendment? Seeing none. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A3 amendment is not adopted. We have a few testifiers who are joining us today. I will remind testifiers to state their full name for the record and limit their testimony to 2 minutes. Mr. Chair, do you want to introduce the testifiers or want me to proceed?
I leave it to the
Very
chair.
Very good. All right. We have Bruce Neustad, president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. Mr. Neustad, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Bruce Neustad with the Minnesota Retailers Association. We work with about a third of our members are small mom-and-pop businesses. About a third are regional retailers, sometimes with a presence outside of Minnesota. And about a third of our members are national retailers. We've just want to take a moment this afternoon to thank Chair Stevenson for working us on this bill and this language and what a price gouging bill might look like. As the chair mentioned, we've done that for a couple of years now relative to how do you draft a good approach or an appropriate approach to what's happening during a state of emergency. And we've worked with other groups, as the chair mentioned, like the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, on this bill structure, really designed to try to distinguish between what a bad actor looks like and what a kind of business following the marketplace might look like as well. We hope this amendment before you today provides some more clarity to consumers and to retailers and to regulators. It's important to just note that in the bill, a key part of it is the requirement of a state of emergency in addition to the invoking of this. We feel like that's a very important part. This doesn't allow price gouging investigations outside a state of emergency. It requires a conscientious effort on the part of the governor to declare not only a state of emergency, but also invoking the price gouging definition. I want to just draw your attention in that spirit to lines 1.18 to 2.2. And that's really, this is about defining what price gouging is not. And we hope that provides a little bit more clarity to the marketplace. And just to summarize that real quick, there's a safe harbor that says price gouging is not a 25% increase or fluctuation of prices. There's a safeguard that says if your prices as a retailer have grown because your supply chain costs have gone up, that is not price gouging. If the market has fluctuated to some degree, that is also not price gouging, and that takes into account seasonality as well. So we appreciate sort of the idea that the chair has crafted around that there is a safe harbor in this bill which defines what price gouging is not in order to provide more clarity to folks as they look at this bill. As drafted, there's probably a couple things we'd love to continue to take a look at. The extension of the period 30 days after a state of emergency we think is worth Further conversation? Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. And as mentioned a moment ago, the civil penalties are a little high as well. But really, it's our hope that given kind of the confined nature of this bill, this really doesn't get invoked too often. And I think that's the chair's hope as well. So we hope it's rarely used. I just want to thank Chair Stevenson for his work on this bill, for the dialogue, for other stakeholders that have participated. And Madam Chair, it's great to be here in person, and I thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you, Mr. Newstead. Next, we have Gary Wordish, the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. Mr. Wordish, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and the committee members for the opportunity. My name is Gary Wordish, and I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization that has represented Minnesota's family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities since 1918. I'm here today to voice MFU's support of House File 6, which would take the long overdue step of prohibiting price gouging in Minnesota. While I talk about the perspective our members have on this issue as farmers, MFU members are also consumers and, like everyone else, have felt the pain of rising prices at the grocery store, the gas pump, and the local pharmacy. Minnesotans have watched the larger corporations earn record profits while the rest of us get squeezed by skyrocketing prices. It is critical that Minnesota has additional tools for cracking down on corporate profiteering and price and prohibiting price gouging as a first step. For family farmers, specifically, our neighbors pay record prices at grocery stores, while consolidated industries like the big four meat packers see massive increases in profits, all the while the farmer's share of the food dollar has dropped from 50% in 1952 to 14.3% in 2021, the lowest on record. As we saw the case from with Sparrowville Farms, we can protect Minnesotans from companies looking to rip them off. But in order to do that, we must join a majority of other states that have laws against price gouging. The importance and need of this legislation to prevent price gouging became evident when, during the pandemic, Sparrowville Foods, or Farms, used their market power to artificially raise the price of their eggs. The Attorney General was only able to correct that because of the governor's emergency powers. I urge this committee to support House File 6, and I want to thank you, Chair Stevenson, as well as Attorney General Ellison, for the work on this important legislation. This bill is a good first step in addressing the harms Minnesotans face from corporate monopolies, and MFU looks forward to working with all of you on this legislation and additional measures that will address the extreme concentration in the economy and ensure fair and competitive markets for Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wordish. Finally, we have Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, please state your name for the record and
Madam Chair, proceed. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. And for those people who may not know me, I've been around for a very long time, maybe old as a lot of pieces of furniture in some of these places. I lobby on privacy and open government, anything related to it, particularly data. And I do it for free. And I've helped past legislators, current ones, and in the B, as I, you know, if I live a little bit longer, to help them in the policy. The bill before you today is giving more power to the Attorney General, which is good. But what happened 4 months ago in a decision called Energy Policy Advocates versus Ellison says, for 40 years, data that would be public after an investigation like this in this situation or of any other powers under the AG is no longer available to the public. And that is a big thing because of the power of the AG. So let's say, for example, that decision didn't happen, emergency happened, and you wanted to know some of the things about what happened under this law, you'd be able to get all kinds of public data. Also in other scenarios. Now what happened with that decision, data is classified in different ways. 13.65 of our state statute says data on individuals are private. And it lays that out. The legislature made that decision. But what happened in a 4-3 decision, the Supreme Court said no. Data on individuals, which is a natural individual, human being, by statute, doesn't mean that. So with companies or non, you know, that stuff is now private. Now, there was a dissent. Thiessen, former Speaker of the House, joined by Gildy and Anderson, basically said, this is Orwellian. And the other says, I find it hard to understand how data can be data on individuals when it is not data on individuals.
Mr. Neumeister, so I'll ask you to wrap it up.
I share that with you because it's something that you, as policymakers, I think, wish to address to bring back the transparency and accountability of a very important office. And this is why there was the tie-in here.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Neumeister.
I want to thank you very much for your few moments of your time. And if you have any questions in that regard, I'm around quite a bit. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 6 today?
I don't know.
And we will move to member discussion and questions. Members? Any discussion? Representative Newbernley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. I'm wondering if you know how many complaints, cases were investigated or opened during Executive Order 2010 during COVID on this issue.
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Newbernley. I don't know the number of cases that were opened or investigations. As I mentioned earlier, there were, I think, 100 cases that reached some form of informal resolution and then 6 court-ordered settlements during the emergency.
Representative Newbernley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Informal resolution, I'm wondering how many of those cases resulted in fines?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, I don't know how many of the 100 cases that were informally resolved resulted, if any, resulted in fines. I don't know.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like maybe we don't have all the information for such a big bill. Thank you.
Members, any? Oh, Chair, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill as amended, I asked this question last year about the practicality of the bill, and there wasn't a clear-cut answer, and so I'm going to ask that question again since the bill is before us in generally the same format, and that is, in a situation where there's a crisis and limited supply of product in an area, for example, gasoline or fuels or what have you, a retailer and or a community may want to reserve those for the greater good of the community, where there's large persons congregating to be able to provide heat and those kinds of things, or to be able to, in a snow or other type of emergency where you're using heavy equipment, particularly where diesel and things like that are in limited supply in our economy right now, that would we be able to, as a retailer, withhold that? And then could you, as a retailer, defer and choose to sell to a particular vendor or a business in your community that you deem is going to be the greater good and doing the greater good for the community to, again, try to help preserve the well-being of your community and your residents?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I think I'm going to direct you to Subdivision 4 of the bill, the prohibition. And it's the only prohibition in the bill, and what it prohibits is selling or offering to sell an essential consumer good or service for an amount that represents an unconscionably excessive price during the period in which the abnormal market disruption declaration is effective. And so I think a lot of the issues that you're, or scenarios that you're putting out when you're discussing what you just were discussing, don't fall within that prohibition. What is prohibited is charging an unconscionably excessive price. Specifically and narrowly that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Stevenson, for the response. Again, I guess I want to know where does the local community have any say in here as to where they would like to see the resources dedicated? I'm gathering from your discussion and your answer that the community can work with the party that owns those resources to try to come to a equitable or amicable settlement and trying to make those available within the community.
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say can or can't?
They may or are allowed to.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I think that we're not restricting local governments or local, authorities or whatever you have beyond what is in the bill. There's a prohibition here against settling an unconscionably excessive price. We know that local government play an important role during an emergency in making sure that people have what they need to survive, and we're not restricting them in any way, shape, or form. We're restricting the ability of merchants to profit to an absurd degree from other people's misery and misfortune.
Representative Driscoll. Thank you. Members, any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Newberly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for asking one more question. But Chair Stevenson, I appreciate the, and as Mr. Newstead pointed out, the what unconscionably excessive is not, is what is unconscionably excessive, is this exclusively to the subjective purview of the Attorney General?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Newbridley. No, it is not. So what the bill does is it creates a safe harbor, and that safe harbor is 25% or less, and then there's some other exceptions for if you're buying on a contract or other things beyond that. But by creating that safe harbor, you're also saying that if you increase prices beyond that, you're in this territory. The Attorney General doesn't get to decide, though. The Attorney General gets to bring a civil action against a retailer, and then it's going to proceed as any other thing where there will be a finding of fact in a court of law, which is how ultimately these things are decided.
Representative Newbridley.
Thank you.
Due process is what I mean to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I do appreciate the what it is not. That's a little unusual in how we govern. Usually we define things instead of excluding definitions. That's a little bit concerning. I'm always concerned when we're putting subjective language into law. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, any further discussion? Okay. Chair Stevenson, any final comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I want to conclude by just saying something that I should have said in my opening, which is that the overwhelming majority of businesses in Minnesota would never do this, would never gouge people. I think that there's example after example of our businesses in Minnesota taking care of Minnesotans during emergencies. And that, I think, is what we expect from our business community and what happens, generally speaking. What this bill is about is punishing the bad actor who would take advantage of that situation. Minnesotans deserve to be protected in that situation, and this bill does that. So I'd ask for a yes vote.
Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 6, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay.
No.
No.
The motion prevails. House File 6, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, we will now turn to our next item on our agenda, which is an overview of insurance law and the insurance industry here in Minnesota. This is, of course, one of the core jurisdictional areas of the Commerce Committee. And to lead off this section of our agenda, we will have a discussion from our Able House researcher, Lori Pompu. Ms. Pompu.
Chair and members, industry representatives are going to give a more fine overview of the specific insurance areas that they work in. But in a broader way, I just want to talk about the Commerce Committee's jurisdiction. There's a lot of different types of insurance products. There's a lot of different type of insurance entities. And there's a lot of parties involved in insurance. Some consumer-facing products that we hear a lot about in commerce are homeowners insurance, renters insurance, auto insurance, life insurance, and investment products related to that, and property and casualty insurance. These involve individuals and Minnesotans in their daily life. And a big picture, we work with insurance companies, insurance agents, which are called producers under state law, and insurance adjusters. Those are covered in chapters 60A, 60K, and 72B. And then a very hot topic always, health insurance. And we cover health insurance policies on an individual basis, a small group basis, a large group basis, and we cover certain joint employer, employee, self-insured arrangements. And we regulate those. From a health insurance perspective, the types, areas that we cover include policies of accident health insurance and nonprofit health service plan corporations. And nonprofit health service plan corporations is Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's it. And those are in chapters 62A, 62C, and 62Q. We do not cover health maintenance organizations. Those are regulated by the Department of Health. However, when we make changes to health insurance law, those get roped in because we tend to treat the group all as one. Commerce also oversees, which is a recent adjustment, pharmacy benefit managers under 62W, which interrelate to our insurance statutes. I'm happy to talk about any and all types of insurance and answer any questions that anyone may have.
Members have questions for Ms. Pompeo. Seeing none, we're going to now hear from a few industry representatives. These are some of our frequent flyers here in the Commerce Committee. First up is Dan Andreessen from the Council of Health Plans. Mr. Andreessen, if you could come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
So thank you, Madam Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Andreessen. I'm the Senior Director of Government Affairs and Policy with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The presentation I'm going to give to you today is just a small subset of a larger presentation that we do for legislators every year that goes into health insurance operations, regulations, and so forth. And we'll be happy to come to your office later to do that presentation for you to get a little more in-depth in this material. So just initially here, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans is a trade association for Minnesota's nonprofit insurers. We don't represent the larger for-profits, it is just the nonprofits here in the state. But we do have a significant footprint here in Minnesota. We cover around 92% of state regulated markets and collectively employ over 40,000 Minnesotans throughout the state. So why have health insurance? So probably the first two reasons you think of is the more financial piece of health insurance. Like other pieces of insurance, it provides financial protections from unexpected situations, but it also helps you finance your healthcare costs throughout the year. So unlike other insurance where you may buy it and not use it, such as car insurance, you're buying health insurance to use it. You're using that to spread out your cost throughout the year as opposed to paying it in larger sums out of pocket every time a situation arises. Although health insurance, you know, is mainly paying claims, but it does provide other services such as helping our enrollees have access to preventative services and wellness initiatives, navigating healthcare choices, and making sure that the care that's being delivered is meeting industry quality standards. Health insurance is, as an entity, is one of the most regulated in federal and the federal and state level. Here at the state level, it's regulated by Departments of Commerce, Health, and Human Services. And it's regulated in multiple different ways. The first is health plan financials. So all health insurers need to be licensed by the state and prove that they're solvent so that they can take on the financial responsibility of insuring their customers, making sure that they can pay claims. All rates that our insurers are providing in the fully insured market have to be approved by Commerce. So there's a rate review process that's actually starting right now for the 2024 plan year, where health plans will submit their rates to Commerce. Commerce will make sure that those rates are actuarial sound and meet what is the expected health care cost for the year. Rates that enrollees pay in terms of premiums is a reflection of health care costs, such as paying for doctors, hospitals, drugs, ambulance, pharmacists. That's what you're paying for when you're paying your premiums. Also, all insurers have to meet what's called medical loss ratios, which is really what it means is that the premiums that you collect, you have to spend a certain percentage of that for health care costs. So if an insurer comes to Commerce, they have to prospectively prove that they're going to be able to meet those ratios. Retrospectively, if they don't, they have to return that money through rebates to their enrollees, and that happened during the COVID pandemic when healthcare use was a little bit lower than expected. Insurers also have coverage requirements. I think a lot of us are familiar with the ACA and its requirement that all pre-existing conditions are covered, as well as the 10 essential health benefits the ACA requires, which includes ambulatory, hospitalization, medications, and so forth. Additionally, states can enact additional mandates that insurers have to follow. Here in Minnesota, there's been over 60 added to that list that all insurers have to provide coverage for. And lastly, provider networks are also regulated. There are network adequacy laws that the state has enacted to make sure that insurers are meeting those standards and providing care to all corners of the state, and broad based of providers. So where do Minnesotans get their health care coverage? There's kind of three main areas. The first one is you can get it from your employer. So the largest one is self-insured plans. This is the large corporations who provide insurance to their employees. They take on the financial risk. It's their health insurance policy. You can also get it if you work for a small employer in the small and large group markets. You can also get it through a program called CGIP, which many of you may be a part of, which is insurance for state employees. This market is heavily subsidized by employers. So as an employee, you pay a little bit out of your paycheck towards your premiums, but your employer is paying the majority of that premium for you. You can also get your health insurance through a federal or state program. Federally, we have the Medicare program for those over at 65, and younger people who are living with disabilities. We have the federal program TRICARE, which is for veterans and active duty military. Medicaid is the state program, known as medical assistance here, for low-income Minnesotans or who live with certain circumstances. And then Minnesota Care, which is Minnesota's basic health program for those who are just a little bit above Medicaid eligibility but under 200% of poverty. In this situation, you pay a little bit out of pocket for this. In some situations, people are not paying anything for their health care. The government subsidizes most of these folks through taxpayer dollars. And then the last bucket is the one that's the least subsidized of the three. This is if you're buying it on your own. So if you can't get insurance other ways, you would go out to MinSure or maybe work with an agent or broker to buy your own policy for you or your family. Now, there are tax credits and so forth out there to help bring down your premiums, but typically people pay more for their premiums because there's just not the same level of subsidization as you see in the other two areas. So this is how it kind of breaks down here in Minnesota. The largest bucket of folks get their insurance from the self-insured corporate plans. And then as you kind of go down the list, you have kind of equal amounts in Medicare and Medicaid, and then the small and large group markets, and then smaller pieces in the other ones. Currently, there's around 4% or so Minnesotans who are not insured in one of these programs. Now, as I wrap up, I just want to leave with one last point is that the reason we kind of bring this up is that where you get your insurance matters, because that helps to determine when situations arise, how we find a solution to that situation. Because that helps for us to decide who the decision maker is, but also how it's regulated by the state or the federal level. And so just to kind of break this down, so the self-insured market, Medicare and TRICARE are all generally regulated federally. And in fact, the self-insured market can't be impacted by state law. So that is because it's preempted by federal law known as ERISA. And so for folks who run into situations with insurance in that area, that actually the best place to go is to their employer who are making those decisions. And so that leaves the rest of our pie chart, which is regulated by the state. So that includes the state public programs, CGIP, and then collectively, sorry to throw out another term to you, but you'll hear this one as we go on, is the fully insured market, which is the individual market and small group market together. And so as legislation is debated, you'll see us kind of asking that question, is do you know where it comes from? Because that will help determine how we find a solution, but also how a certain bill is going to impact insurance markets here in the state. So This is our canceled staff list. Happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. And just for members' benefit, if you were having difficulty seeing the slides, we did email out Mr. Andreessen's presentation, including the charts, so that you can see them in your email. They're not in your packets, however. Are there questions for Mr. Andreessen? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is not as much for Mr. Andreessen as maybe for Ms. Pompeo. About Mr. Andreessen spoke about approval of rates for health insurance. And I, Ms. Pompeo, could you kind of explain to what degree Commerce actually approves rates for health insurance? I mean, I'm sure what Mr. Andreessen said about, you know, I know they look at certain things, but it's sort of my understanding that they don't actually approve the rates as such. Could you clarify that for me? Thanks.
Ms. Pompeo.
Chair and members, I'm sure the Department of Commerce can provide more context as well, but they look for actuarial justification. It's not necessarily saying this is the correct number that you came to, but they're making sure that they are based on justifiable means.
Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe when the department is here at some point, they could expand on that a little bit. But I think it's sort of an important distinction, because I often do actually get questions from constituents, not always about health insurance, but different kinds of insurance that we have in Minnesota, the degree to which the state actually approves the actual rates or not. And I think it's probably different in different areas of insurance as well. So it would just be a good thing to get clarification on at some point. Thanks.
Other questions for Mr. Andreessen? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on the medical loss ratios. If you could just comment on what that current number is and if that number fluctuates over near and short term.
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman. So right now for the individual market, it is 80%. It is 85% for the small and large group market. There's also a medical loss ratio for the Medicaid program, and that's 85%. So that number is state statute. The first two I gave you are set by the ACA.
Representative Bierman?
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. Just wondering then, so this is for the so-called nonprofits, and I'm wondering if the change in Minnesota with for-profit health insurance, if the for-profits have any sort of medical loss ratios that they are held to, or is it sky's the limit?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman. So all insurers have to follow the medical loss ratios. The big difference is what happens with your margins and needing to meet a nonprofit threshold that you have to in the state. So that's the big difference between the two. You know, I can say from a nonprofit standpoint, our margins are anywhere from 1% to 3%. I can't speak to what the for-profit margins are, but that's kind of how it's laid out.
Representative Bierman? Any further questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Andreessen, for being here today. I just want to follow up on Representative Bierman's question. When he raised the question, I was thinking that he's talking about health insurance, and we don't. I know that we changed the law a few years ago to allow for-profit health providers to come in. We've always had for-profit health providers in some of the supplement markets and some of the other areas. And so I want to just make sure, since we have so many new people who are on this committee and people who are tuning in for the first time, that there's some clarity on the type of product that we're talking about. We have, again, in the Medicare supplement area and other products had for-profit companies offering those, and that would be a whole completely different loss ratio that you'd be looking at, because it's a supplemental versus a primary policy like you'd see in the policies that you're here today representing. So maybe we weren't exactly apples to apples when we were talking about that, because I don't know that we have any private health providers as primary payers in the state of Minnesota as a result of that law.
And for clarity, when you say providers, you mean insurers.
Correct. But payers is what I meant to say.
Yeah.
I'm just a little nervous with all these people here. They're not always on Zoom.
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, maybe to kind of clarify, so because I went through this really quick. So you do, in like the self-insured market, you would have like a for-profit providing care to through their employers. What happened with the law change that was spoken of, that was regarding the the fully insured market, so the individual small group market, and then the Medicaid market. With the change in that law, for-profits were able to enter those markets. Beforehand, you had to be a nonprofit in order to be part of those.
Representative Driscoll. Any further questions for Mr. Andreessen? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for your testimony. Next, we're going to turn to a different type of insurance and hear from Aaron Cocking from the Insurance Federation. For the first time, but not the last this year, welcome to the committee, Mr. Cocking. If you could come up and state
sure
your
about that?
That's up to you, I guess. State your name for the record and proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. Welcome back. My name is Aaron Cocking. I'm the president and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The Insurance Federation of Minnesota has been the voice of insurance at the Capitol for over 100 years. We exist to represent the voices of policyholders and insurers to legislators and regulators, especially when you're making decisions about insurance. I look forward to bringing that voice to the committee again this year. Particularly, I represent the property casualty side of the insurance industry. Property meaning coverage that financially protects you if the property you own is damaged, lost, or stolen. And casualty, which provides protection if you're responsible for causing injury to another person or damage to their property. These encompass personal lines insurance such as auto, home, and renters, as well as commercial insurance, which includes commercial property, commercial auto, workers' compensation, which this committee doesn't have jurisdiction over, and business insurance. Now, as most of you know, I think insurance is a contract which transfers risk from the policyholder to an insurer to protect some type of asset. This transfer of risk allows us all to live higher quality lives because we know that our protected asset is insured. Some of you have heard me say this before, and as Chair Stevenson referenced, I'm sure I'll be back again this year saying the same thing. We're better off as a result of insurance. We live higher quality lives. We drive nicer vehicles. We live in nicer homes. We have nicer things because of the protection afforded to us by insurance. However, insurance is unlike any other type of product or service because insurers don't know exactly what their cost will be when they sell their product. Instead, they rely on the law of large numbers to statistically predict what they can expect this cost to be. The people who work to determine this price are called actuaries, and they take all the possible data that they can to determine what the price the insurance product needs to be sold at to ensure that future losses will be paid. So as you consider legislation this year, consider that each additional requirement that you mandate comes at a cost. Whether it's requiring coverage of someone else in the policy, requiring a higher limit, mandating coverage that is currently voluntary, all of that comes at a cost to the policyholder. And why is that? Well, in most basic terms, additional costs require additional premium to pay those losses. Actuaries will look at the decisions made in Minnesota and determine if additional premium will be required to cover those additional risks. Insurance has a lot of terms that we use, probably more so than a lot of other industries. We use the terms frequency and severity as we look at loss trends. Frequency means how often or how many claims a company has, while severity means the cost of each of those claims. For example, when COVID hit and people were driving less, we saw fewer accidents, leading to less frequency. But the accidents that did happen were more severe and more expensive, a rise in severity. Any action that pushes either side of that equation higher will come at a cost. Now, many of you have probably seen an increase in your insurance premiums over the past few years and might be wondering, why is that? And I want to hit that head on as we, I'm sure, will engage a lot in this coming year. Let me offer you a couple of reasons based on what we're seeing in the industry. First, on the auto side, repairing and replacing vehicles has become incredibly more complex and expensive. The cost of parts and labor and the process involved in fixing newer vehicles is much more intense and expensive than it was even 10 years ago. And on cars that have been deemed a total loss, the availability of used cars has been much tighter than we are used to seeing. We all know from Econ 101 and kind of even the last bill that was heard that as supply constricts, prices generally go higher. And those higher costs are reflected in the form of higher premium. Now, on the homeowner side, much of the increased costs are as a result of Minnesota weather. Minnesota has the second most extreme weather of any state in the country. Wind and hail lead to some of the costliest repairs consumers face. The changing climate has led to more intense storms more often. For the first time in as long as many people can remember, Minnesota had tornadoes in December of 2021. Tornadoes in December. Most companies had long assumed that by the time December rolled around, they were done with those types of claims for the year. Turns out that might not be true. Chair Stevenson has heard me talk about this before, but we often point to the storms that rolled through the North Metro in June of 2017. Those storms were the most expensive storm in Minnesota history, causing $3.2 billion in damage in a matter of minutes. That was the 10th most expensive storm in the world that year, in the world. Those policyholders were made whole from their loss, but in exchange, future premiums had to increase. So you might be wondering, how do we know that the companies aren't using these storms as a pretext to raise rates? And it's because insurers are a regulated industry. In Minnesota, we're regulated by the Department of Commerce, as Dan mentioned in his testimony, who review these things. More specifically, in 1945, and I don't want to go into a deep history lesson, but Congress delegated the regulation of the business of insurance via the McCarran-Ferguson Act. And our industry is fully supportive of state-based insurance regulation. We believe that you guys will do a better job of regulating the business of insurance than people in D.C. When there are issues in Minnesota, it's easier to resolve them by reaching out to someone at the DOC who understands our issues than it is to connect with a bureaucrat in D.C. And the issues faced in the Minnesota market are different than the issues faced in California or Colorado or Florida or any other coastal state. It's great to have a Minnesotan working on those issues with us. It's not to say that we have a cozy relationship with the DOC by any stretch of the imagination. The Department of Commerce is able to regulate our industry by doing market conduct exams, which is looking at how companies operate in the market. They also review and approve rates and forms to make sure that they comply with the laws that this legislature passes. So as we start the process this year, as you consider legislation that impacts our industry, we will oppose bills that prevent insurers from having the freedom to underwrite in a way that is best for their policyholders. We'll also oppose any additional coverage mandates that will drive up the price for Minnesota policyholders. I thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of kind of our niche area of the insurance industry. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other a fair amount this year, but I'm happy to answer questions now, or if you have questions as they come up, happy to reach out.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking, and I'll lead off with some questions, and I appreciate, as you have done consistently when you appear before this committee, talking about the impact that our changing climate has had on insurance rates here in Minnesota. I saw my homeowner's premium jump by a huge extent this year, and when I spoke to my insurance company about it, that's exactly what they pointed to, was the prevalence of extreme weather events caused by climate change. And I know, as you said in your remarks, and as when I go to conferences around the country talking about insurance law, this is a national, international phenomenon. I just will note for the record, $3.2 billion of damage in the North Metro, but I still didn't get a new roof out of that somehow. Very, very frustrating. You didn't either? Well, you got two new roofs. I couldn't even get one. Anyway. I wanted to ask you about resiliency measures, Mr. Cocking, and to what extent you're seeing companies in Minnesota offer incentives to homeowners to adopt, more resilient homes, that can better resist hail damage and other damage, and what's the leading trend on resiliency and insurance in Minnesota?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mr. Chairman. As we see our industry obviously has a vested interest in making sure that as we build additional buildings and as things come about, we build them in a way where we don't have to rebuild them, where Representative Kegel doesn't have to get two new roofs in the span of a couple years, because we're developing things, whether it's hail-resistant shingles, whether it's hurricane ties for roofs, kind of what can we do? There's an organization called the IBHS, International Building Housing, whatever. I'll follow up. It's the IBHS. But it's that entity exists and is funded by the insurance industry to kind of look at what do these different storms, what is the impact that they have, what can we do to design buildings in such a way where they're able to kind of withstand these different types of weather, whether it's hail, whether it's wind, tornadoes. We don't have kind of the same issues that coastal states do with hurricanes and stuff like that. But we certainly have an interest in making sure, because the fewer roofs that we have to pay for because they're not damaged as a result of the increased storm frequency that we're seeing, it's better for policyholders, it's better for companies too.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think that your testimony just brings home for a lot of people the real impact that climate change is already having here in Minnesota. I think people think of it often as a theoretical thing or something that's happening somewhere else, but it's costing Minnesotans money right now in a very real way. Other questions for Mr. Cocking? Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is something that we can flesh out in my committee, but I was just kind of curious how the insurance industry is kind of, how are you guys leading the way when it comes to those sustainable and resilient materials? Do you see any opportunities coming up through some of the federal bills that might be able to, that your industry could take advantage of? And how do we build that collaboration and across the agencies that?
Yeah, it's interesting, Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle. Congress had done some work on this a couple of years ago, and we had found as part of our industry that for every dollar that you put in kind of on pre-disaster mitigation, you save $8 on the back end. So the more that we can do to make these buildings more resilient, and the more that, you know, at that point it was kind of Congress giving some money, whether it was to states, and a lot of that was around building codes, and that's kind of a whole other issue in Minnesota, as we don't kind of have a uniform and adopted and an enforced building code statewide in Minnesota, to be able to take advantage of some of that money to be able to do that stuff. But the more money that we can, the more that you can do on the front end saves when those storms hit.
I'll just say that the deficiencies in our building codes have been long noted and perhaps something there will be action on this year. Anything else, Representative Cagle? Any further questions for Mr. Cocking? Representative Cleaborn.
Yeah, this is just kind of a general knowledge question, not that it's going to really impact the work that we're doing this year, but just kind of curious. So when you're looking at the insurance industry as a whole, and maybe if you said this quickly in your introduction, I missed it. So the total premiums received by fire, casualty, property, and then total payouts, I think it helps people understand just the magnitude of what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair,
pop quiz, Mr. Cocking.
Representative Cleaborn, I have to admit I was not prepared for that question. I don't have that answer off the top of my head. I will get that and provide it to your office. I would say, and we've seen this on auto especially, there's this notion that kind of insurers are always, you know, making money hand over fist, and we always kind of look at what do you see in a combined ratio, which is kind of expenses and losses paid out. And generally speaking, the combined ratios of insurers, specifically on auto insurance, exceeds 100%, which means we pay out more in losses than we collect in premium. But let me get you the answers, and I can break it down by line for you, too, so we have that information.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking.
Thank you.
Last in our insurance section, but certainly not least, is Robin Rowan from the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. Ms. Rowan, if you could state your name and proceed your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan, and today I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MIFC. If you have trouble remembering the name, think of something your grandmother might name her poodle, or if there's any children of the 80s here, maybe a name from the preppy handbook. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about what I think are clearly the most exciting lines of insurance. And so my member companies write, my member companies protect the financial security of Minnesotans in every stage of their life and often when things are at their worst. So we write life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, retirement and pension products, and paid family and medical leave benefits, as well as supplemental benefits like vision and dental. So every day in Minnesota alone, life insurers pay out $41.7 million in life insurance and annuities to Minnesota families and businesses. MIFC's members also support 53,000 jobs, and that includes all of the agents and financial advisors that we have in every corner of the state. As you get to work on the myriad of insurance bills that I'm sure will come in front of this committee, I would urge you to keep a couple of things in mind. First, to keep insurance affordable, it is critical to allow insurers to accurately account for risk. But it's also really important to us, to MIFC's members, that products are accessible to all Minnesotans. And so, for example, we worked with Representative Cagle a couple years ago to make sure that people who have a prescription of an opioid antidote or antagonist solely to help others are able to get life insurance. And we worked with the National Kidney Foundation last year on a Representative Her bill to make sure that organ and tissue donors also have accessibility to affordable insurance. So in closing, please consider us as a resource. We're happy to help you with any questions you or your constituents might have. Also, if you have a burning desire to learn more about annuities, we can do that too, although they are the only product that offers guaranteed income for life. So thank you for your time, and I'm very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I'll lead off by asking, I'm sure you were, if not here, watching last week when we were hearing from the commissioner about the current status of the insurance division in the Department of Commerce and some staffing challenges there. And I wonder if you could talk about your company's experience, the companies that you represent, experience in dealing with the Commerce Department and with regard to staffing issues in particular, and if you see a need for more resources in that division.
Mr. Chair, yes. Our business, as you've heard from the previous testifiers, is highly dependent upon the Department of Commerce. They approve our forms, they approve our rates. We can't do our business unless they're functioning correctly. So it's very important, and we've always been a big supporter of the department, and especially the division of insurance. Sometimes I feel like, you know, energy is the, you know, sort of the sexier sister, but it's really important that the Department of Insurance be adequately funded so that we can continue to grow and prosper. Minnesota actually has a really robust life insurance industry here, and we're highly dependent upon their functioning well.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Rowan from members? Looks like you're getting off easy from this crowd.
Today.
Thank you, Ms. Ron.
Thank you.
The next time on our agenda is our overview of the telecommunications industry and state regulation. And first, we will welcome to the committee Bob Eliff from House Research to give us a brief overview of the regulatory regime in this area here in Minnesota. Welcome to the Commerce Committee, Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. Mr. Chair, I was asked to give a very short talk on telecommunications, and that's only appropriate because the scope of state jurisdiction over telecommunications has been significantly reduced over the past several decades and continues to shrink every year. So what I propose to talk about today is a very short history of how that came about and where it leaves us. That'll be the focus of my remarks today. The situation is the result of three factors, basically. First, technological advances in telecom, which continue every day. Second, federal law regarding the degree to which these new technological developments should be regulated at the federal and state level. And third, actions taken here by the Minnesota legislature in reaction to these developments. Let me start with Minnesota, the regulations that have changed the regulation for wireline customers, old-fashioned telephones. POTS, they're called, plain old telephone service. Historically, regulation has been a substitute for competition in markets where a monopoly provider exists. This was the case in telecom through most of the 20th century when Ma Bell reigned supreme and small telephone companies in rural areas were the sole providers of those services in those areas. Back then, state public utility commissions regulated these companies very closely, examining their expenditures, their revenues, their prices, and the quality of their service. The same way public utilities commissions today regulate public utilities with respect to energy provision. As the cell phone market expanded greatly during the 1990s, the number of copper-based wireline access lines began to decline in the face of that competition. Regulation was relaxed by the legislature in 1995, allowing the operation of much more lenient alternative regulation plans that were actually negotiated between companies and the commission. 20 years later, competition continued apace, and the legislature, recognizing that relaxed price regulation of wireline companies even more. A local exchange was deemed to be competitive if 60% of the households in that local exchange could receive or could be offered voice services by a competitor. And if that was the case, a much lighter regulatory burden was deemed appropriate, and most price regulation disappeared. Out of about 200 local telephone exchanges in the state at that point, only a handful did not meet those criteria at this point. So what's left for wireless customers in Minnesota with respect to regulation? Well, one thing that I have to state is that telephone companies, like all businesses in Minnesota, are subject to prohibitions against fraud, misrepresentation, and deceptive practices. That hasn't changed. There is a last, was a last vestige of price regulation in that 2016 law. Beginning this year, a company cannot increase monthly rates for basic residential telephone service by more than $2 a month, and any change has to cannot be changed for 12 months after that. There are also some specific operations that are prohibited. You can't switch a customer's carrier without the customer's authorization. That's a process known as slamming. You can't charge a customer for services that the customer has not expressly authorized. That's a process known as cramming. Companies have to advise customers of their prices at least once a year, and they have to advise customers of the availability of call blocking services that the companies offer. And telephone companies cannot intentionally impair the speed or the quality of their services. They're also required to collect fees from customers for two programs that operate in Minnesota. One is the telephone assistance plan, which provides a reduction in the monthly charge for telephone service to people of very low incomes, cuts it by $10 a month. And second is the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program, which is run by the Department of Human Services and the Commission, which provides equipment for deaf, hard of hearing, and other persons with disabilities that impair their ability to use the communications system. Those charges for that telecommunications services are 3 cents a month per line, and the total program is about $4.5 million. That's where wireline is. Let me talk a little bit about wireless because that regulation has taken a different path. Back in 1993, Congress passed the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, which stated, with respect to cell phones, no state or local government shall have any authority to regulate the entry or rates charged by commercial mobile service. So no state authority to regulate entry or rates. This trend toward deregulation was strengthened by the growth of the internet and its application to voice services, which had previously been supplied exclusively by telephone companies. In the Telecommunications Act of 1996, Congress stated, "It is the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services, unfettered by federal or state regulation." The mid-1990s saw the advent of a new technology, voice over internet protocol, VoIP. It's a process that converts analog voice signals to digital signals, compresses them into packets, and most importantly, transmits those packets to the party that's called over the internet rather than through a local telephone company. As you can imagine, it's more economical, no long distance charges. Moreover, VoIP transmission could be combined with existing copper wire lines to transmit voice signals for only part of that journey to the caller, and companies could also adopt it without the customers actually doing anything, and most customers don't know if they have it or they don't. Interestingly, companies providing VoIP services claim that under the definitions in that 1996 Telecommunications Act, they were not providing telecommunication services to their customers at all, because by transforming that data into packets, they were providing what the Act defined as an information service, like the internet. And like the internet, they were therefore exempt from regulation. In 2003, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission took a company to U.S. District Court on that very point and lost. The court agreed that the company only used the telecommunications service to deliver its information service, but it was not a telecommunications service itself. In effect, it said a phone call is not a phone call when it travels over the internet. The 1993 federal law, which prohibited regulation by states of entry or rates, did reserve authority for states for other terms and conditions of wireless phone services. A lot of these are the same things I mentioned with respect to wireline. Tap, TAM, and 9/11 fees are charged to wireless companies. The anti-slamming and the anti-cramming provisions are the same, but there's some that pertains particularly to cell phones. Smartphones have to be sold in the state with anti-theft protection. There is no liability for the unauthorized use of a cell phone if it's lost or stolen. Wireless companies cannot disclose customer phone numbers. Law enforcement agencies that want to obtain cell phone records must obtain a warrant to do so. One other thing I can say about these other terms and conditions that states may use pertains to Minnesota and kind of to me personally. The first year I was in the legislature, 2004, I drafted a bill for a member who said if a company wants to make a substantive change in an existing contract with a wireless customer that would either increase the price or lengthen the term of the contract, the customer had 60 days to opt in to that change. If the customer did not opt in within 60 days, the existing terms and conditions of the contract would continue until the end of that contract. The court said this was price regulation because for those 60 days, the prices couldn't be changed and it was disallowed. So that's the type of thing that can't be done by states. That concludes my talk, and I'm happy to stay around for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Eliff. Questions from the committee for Mr. Eliff? Seeing none, we look forward to seeing you in the near future, Mr. Eliff. Our next testifier on the subject is Brent Christensen from the Telecom Alliance. Mr. Christensen, if you could come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed your testimony. And they also have a presentation.
I do.
Wonderful. And like the last one, it is in your email. Oh, it's not in your email, but it will be. Later.
It will be.
Mr. Christensen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and give you a little bit of overview about the MTA. I think that's going to fit in very nicely with what Mr. Eliff presented. A little bit about MTA. We've been around since 1909. We are made up of 41 companies. 22 of them are member-owned cooperatives. There are 9 family-owned companies. Where I come from, I'm fifth generation telecom guy. We have 5 commercial companies, Lumen is one of those. And we have 2 competitive local exchange carriers, which were created in the 1996 Act that Mr. Eliff was talking about, that are wholly owned by the incumbent providers. And then we have 2 others. We have 2 companies in Minnesota that are owned by other companies. And then we have 1 incumbent municipally owned telephone company in Barnesville. Telecom is the only competitive utility. If you remember nothing else of what I say today, that's important to remember. It's not like electricity, not like gas, not like water. There is competition in our world. Briefly, I'm going to talk about the 3 main lines of business that our members are involved in. As Mr. Eliff said, plain old telephone service, or POTS, which is landline telephone service. So just think of it as just landlines. And it comes from a telco, not a cable provider. And we provide broadband internet. We're working with the state of Minnesota, the Office of Broadband Development, to develop border-to-border broadband. And then video services, broadcast video services. You'd think of them as cable TV. And they're provided over phone service. And I want to talk a little bit about, since this is the Commerce Committee, about how each of those lines of businesses are regulated. Our plain old telephone service, or POTS, landline telephone service, is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, the Department of Commerce, the Office of the Attorney General, and the Federal Communications Commission. Our competitors with the cable industry and the wireless industry are regulated by the FCC. If that doesn't look fair to you, you're right. Our broadband internet, we're regulated by the FCC. And then we have limited PUC oversight when we accept certain federal programs. And that's when we're designated as an eligible telecommunications carrier, or ETC. And the same thing in the broadband world for our competitors. Our video services are regulated by local franchise agreements and then to some degree by the FCC, which is the same for the cable companies. And I know I only had a couple minutes, so I want to be real brief. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Questions from the members? Well, I have a question.
Yes,
you mentioned that telecom is the only competitive utility. So in my house, I have basically two options for internet. I can get internet through Lumen and sort of over the wires DSL type service, or I can get it through Comcast to get the higher speed cable internet. And I suppose in some sense you could say that that's competition, that I have two providers, but I think, you know, with the amount of speed that's necessary to exist in the modern world, I'm not sure that you really have even two. I think there might be just really the one option in terms of Comcast. So my question is, what percentage of Minnesotans do you think have a competitive choice that they get to make about where they receive their internet services or their telecommunication services these days?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say it's pretty much close to 100%, because the one you didn't put in there were the wireless carriers. We have customers that cut the cord all the time, and they will get a fixed wireless solution, or they'll get service from their wireless carrier, and it looks the same to them as their wireline service. That's not available everywhere, but they're typically, the Office of Broadband will tell you there is a choice. My competitive utility was really focused on landline telephone service.
Fair enough.
And our landline telephone line business line is dropping through the floor as people cut the cord, and being replaced by cell phones.
Very fair. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Christensen. Always a pleasure to see you. Our last testifier is Andrew Schreiner from Lumen. Mr. Schreiner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Schreiner. How does that work?
You just have to.
All right. I am Director of Government Affairs for Lumen. You're probably more familiar with CenturyLink. Lumen is a name that's evolved over the last couple of years. I want to just
okay.
That didn't work. Did we lose?
Sorry. Technology is great when it works.
We thought putting this on one laptop would take care of it.
I'm sorry, I can't get it going. Did it turn on? And I'm not purposely sabotaging him.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just kind of wing it without, yeah. Without the PowerPoint.
Sounds like it's running.
Is it up?
There we go.
There it is.
All right.
We got it.
I wanted to give you a sense of some of the businesses that CenturyLink operations has within the organization. Approximately 75% of our revenue comes from outside of what you would consider the traditional consumer voice service, broadband service. Areas such as network security, cybersecurity threats, things like that are really a growing part of our business, especially in the enterprise business space. It's working. Is it working?
Yeah. All right. Well, it was working until you broke it.
Must be the plate in my head. All right. Just talk a little bit about the company. In Minnesota, we have 930,000 connections, and that's connections to cell towers, connections to consumers, businesses, We have about $126 million in salary, $127 million in investment in the network in 2021. 1,500 employees. We're the 911 provider to the state, although that contract is out for an RFP right now, so the state will be looking at 911 providers. And we're a major provider of other services to the state, as well as a lot of the local governments around the state. I want to talk a little bit about Marketplace and what's going on in the market. Bob Eliff did an excellent presentation to kind of wrap you through what's happened over the last 20-some years. But the 1995 Telecom Act, as he mentions, was really the stimulus for a lot of the change we see. Back in 2017, we, as a result of legislation that was passed, went through a proceeding at the Public Utilities Commission that took a look at all the markets that we serve in the state and determine if they met a competitive test. That test was negotiated by various stakeholders and had input from all different parties, and it was something we came to consensus on and were able to move that forward. All but five of our exchanges were found competitive. And I think as I go back and look at those five state exchanges, wire centers as we call them, those would probably meet the test today because there's been substantial fiber investment, not only by our company, but by other companies in those communities. We talked a little bit about wireless service. You know, there's over 4 million. We consider the wireless industry a direct competitor of ours. Consumers are making choices for voice service, and they're choosing mobility over the wired connection. We're seeing, you know, that throughout all demographics, and we're seeing that in all areas of the state, whether it's, you know, Bemidji or Virginia. It's consistent with the cutting the cord that Brent had mentioned. Cable and VoIP were mentioned earlier, so I won't go into that. I think one of the takeaways for today is voice service is going away. It's declining. Year after year, it's been on an average 10% decline. We've gone as a company from 2 million voice lines back in the year 2000 to about 243,000 today. And so we're continuing to see that spiraling effect of consumers picking alternative services. But if I ask you to raise your hand, a lot of you don't are wireless only. I'm wireless only at my home. Have found that to work. Not everyone finds that to work, and we recognize that and acknowledge there's still demand out there for that service. The Department of Commerce did a study this past summer, and I've got some concerns with it, but one of the things they found is 18% of households are thinking about dropping their landline. The flip side is 82% want to keep it today. But if 18,000 are thinking of dropping in the next 12 months, for us, that'd be over 40,000 access lines. So there's this constant ongoing churn where folks are making decisions to cut their wire line. One of the interesting facts I found, too, regarding voice service and wireless service is that more than 98% of households today have a wireless phone or a wireless and a home phone. So we're talking about the reliance on the wire line is really 1.5-2%. And that's a Center for Disease Control number and study. Today, consumers are demanding higher broadband speeds. The state broadband goals are challenging. They are wanting service to all four corners of the state. We're trying to do our best to get there. We have about 300,000 living units that we pass, or living units and businesses that we pass with fiber to the home. We're making more investment in that service over the next few years. So hopefully we're gonna hit areas like Champlain Park that might have a gap in coverage right now. And finally, the state and federal broadband grant programs that Brent mentioned, those are something that we're relying on as well as others. Now, real quickly, I wanna wrap up on marketplace challenges. Our industry is no different than any other industry, whether you're the state government hiring employees or any other entity. Competition for employees is tremendous right now. We've had challenges in hiring employees in key roles. Supply chain right now is impacting the ability of providers to deploy services. Fiber's in high demand. There's a lot of competition for the fiber that's out there. there's also a limited number of vendors in the marketplace that are doing different kinds of work. So that's a challenge for not only our company, but for the members of MTA. Copper theft right now is at an all-time high. There's been a lot of copper theft in our network over the last several months. It's not only Minnesota, but it's in other states as well. Permitting delays are a challenge. We're finding permitting delays. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus or point fingers right now. We're trying to work with those delays and those barriers in the process, but they are providing some delays. And then the last piece are some of the legacy regulatory obligations that apply and prioritize voice service over broadband service are presenting some challenges. And so we hope to have discussions about that with stakeholders over the next several months or next two sessions, if that's what it takes, to try to find ways to make investment to benefit our consumers, your constituents, our customers, and your constituents. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm done with my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Member questions, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this question is kind of thinking about the move towards cellular wire net or internet. What kind of investments then should we, I mean, is laying broadband still going to be something that's necessary? Or, you know, we've got this, you know, the Starlink and, or what did I call it?
Skynet.
wrong one. But, I mean, we just recently, you know, cut off our lumen and moved to wireless. and it's nice because we have just as good a service at home as we do at our cabin. And so I'm kind of curious about how that technology is, you know, how that's going to kind of change our plans moving forward.
Mr. Schreiner.
Can I take that?
Sure, Mr. Christensen. And then okay. Mr. Schreiner, I don't know if you want to speak to it as well. Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for that question because that's a really good one that just reinforces the competition point that I was trying to make. I tell people that we put the wire in wireless. The only thing wireless is from the tower to your handset or the tower to your modem in your house, and the rest of it's wire. We have, the rural independents have built out a fiber network, and we connect and we contract with a lot of the wireless providers, and we connect fiber to those between those towers so that they can give faster speeds and offer faster speeds. And I know it doesn't make sense, but we're actually fueling our own competition by selling in a different way. Starlink, you know, some people have good experience. I think once you get more people on it, I don't think it's going to be as good. But it's competition, and people are making that choice. And so we have to offer things that are different than that. And we offer being local. We offer, you know, being in the communities and things like that to try and get customers. But we do compete with them. That's a fact.
Mr. Schreiner, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
No, I got kicked under the table, so I'll let
All right.
And I would say, Mr. Chairman, one final thing I'd like to say is I think our industry is at a transition period right now from that copper to the fiber. And you're seeing it in the energy space from, you know, carbon to a clean energy future. We're trying to make a similar transition in our industry. And, you know, some nudges from the state would be, I think, helpful to the industry and to consumers if that were to happen.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and we're sort of at time here today. We will be meeting on Wednesday when we'll be taking up the cannabis bill. There will be no meeting on Monday in observance of Martin Luther King Day. Start Wednesday, we may do more overview, or we may take up bills to be determined. And I don't know if that answered all of your questions, Representative O'Driscoll, or if you've got anything. You're good? All right. Well, thank you. That concludes our meeting for today. Meeting adjourned.